So I've made an introductory slide in which I thought I'd put down a list of not all, but some of the papers which have influenced the kind of work that I've been doing, so that one has a record of that, and they will be mentioned from time to time during the talk, and I haven't given the references on the individual slides. And basically, my plan of attack is to, first of all, discuss some of the properties of calculations when you put in spin-orbit interaction. Because most people are not bothering too much about that, and most people here are interested in such things as localization. And quite frankly, that's sensible not to bother about spin-orbit interaction in most cases. There's plenty of trouble out there. You don't have to go looking for it. They're making things more complicated than they need be. But we've been particularly interested in the problem of orbital magnetic moments, and I would claim that there is a serious problem in calculating them accurately. And if there's a serious problem in calculating them accurately, that means there's a serious problem in calculating magnetic anisotropies, which arise, in fact, from spin-orbit interaction. And if there's a problem there, then there's a problem with, for example, calculating magnetic anisotropies in cases which are really quite important, such as at surfaces and multilayers and so on. So I'll talk a little bit about the spin-orbit interaction, and it's basically reminding you of some of the relativistic physics, which you already know but probably don't use too much. Then I, during this talk, will reach the conclusion that basically there is a problem with the local spin density approximation. I will not claim there's a problem with the local density approximation, but with the spin density approximation when one has large spin-orbit coupling. And so one wants to do something about that, and in fact, one gets involved in the problem of looking at Coulomb interactions, exchange interactions from a, I would say, an atomic point of view, and one gets involved in looking at Slater integrals and so on, and one finds, of course, they need to be screened. So I'm going to try to use the simplest possible screening approximation and then look at the kind of results that delivers. So that then will be the third part, where I actually will try to calculate some of these exchange integrals with screening. And then I will give some examples which have been specifically chosen for special reasons. First of all, I don't think one can ever avoid iron, cobalt, and nickel as three classic metals where there are very small orbital moments and where there's been a lot of theory has been done with which one can compare to see whether one is getting sensible results. And then these three very difficult cases where the orbital moments are playing a critical role and where there has been a lot of experimental work done and where the experimentalists have told us in the past that we were getting it wrong. So basically, without going through all of the history, let's say at the outset that if the spin-orbit interaction is small, the local spin density approximation actually produces rather good values for the spin magnetic moments throughout the periodic table. We don't think there's a great problem there. And it's a very robust theory in that sense. But if spin-orbit coupling is introduced and one looks at itinerant materials or materials we think are itinerant, where the orbital moments are calculated using spin-orbit coupling, they almost invariably come out to be too small from the theory. So,
how precise are the experimental measurements of those orbital moments?
This will come up during the talk, but let me say that I have doubts about, for example, nickel and some of those for reasons which I'll go into as regards how do you measure the orbital moments, can you use the form factor and so on, and I'll discuss in some detail in a couple of the cases. But it's a point, of course. So it's always a question. When we go to a lot of trouble to do these theories, do we sometimes delude ourselves by trying to get agreement with experiments which actually are not very accurate? That's a
There are at least some materials where orbital moment is known exactly.
What do you mean exactly?
Exactly means that these materials have compensation of spin and orbital moment, so it's known that they are equal. This high accuracy, but these are F materials, but nevertheless.
You mean the G factor is zero?
Yeah. That can be measured, you know, zero, you can measure that.
And finally, the kind of theory that I'm looking for, which is that I would like to be able to describe a range of materials from 3D transition metals to uranium compounds using one single theory without changing anything. Okay, I would be happy to take errors of 10%, 15%, but what I do not like is the idea that one has to readjust one's theory whenever one changes somewhere in the periodic table. It's rather an unhappy situation, one has to do that.
So it will not directly relate to what you say, but your first line was also not really was not really true. I can give you a list of maybe half a dozen materials right away where spin orbit interaction is very small, which are itinerant, and LSDS spin moments are totally wrong.
Oh, you would actually even go further and criticize the spin moments from LSDA.
It's a question about what about right means.
Yes, it's a question. How you say totally wrong? Do you mean out by 100%?
More than that. That's like off by a factor of three. When the moments are small, then the relative error can be very large. Like instead of 0.2, you can get 0.7. Instead of 0, you can get 0.6. And there are many materials like that, not one.
Instead of 1, you can get 0.
Those are correlated materials. I mean, that we all know. When I speak about things like iron, aluminum, manganese, aluminum, zirconium, zinc, 2. This manganese impurity in palladium.
Okay. Well, you're going to go further than I'm going to go. I'm not going to be that strict. I'm going to say that I don't find this to be the major problem. I find that this one, the things we've been doing, is more serious. But fair enough. I mean, I haven't worked on all of these various compounds, but I looked at a fair number of magnetic materials, and I find sometimes that what LSDA gives is quite amazing. I mean, for example, even in rare earths, with a polarized, localized F system, you get the conduction electron moments extremely good, given by LSDA. So on the whole, I don't find it that bad. You have to remember, again, there's this problem of trying to describe the entire periodic table within one single framework is the thing which I regard fairly important. But yes, there may be pathological cases. I don't know them all. So this slide is supposed to illustrate where one should look if one is looking at the problems of orbital magnetism. The controlling factor is, quite definitively, is the ratio of the bandwidth to the size of the spin orbit splitting. That is, you can have quite a large spin orbit splitting, as you do in the 5Ds, but you'll find very small orbital moments, because the wider the bands, the more the quenching of the orbital moment. So if we're going to look for cases where we expect to find the orbital moments large, then you would look at the end of the 3D series, where they're still quite small, but then you might look at them in a reduced symmetry, for example, in a multilayer at a surface or something like this, where the bandwidth has been narrowed, and then the ratio of the size of the spin orbit splitting to the bandwidth would be increased. And of course, you find this already in the elements in the 5F series, where the spin orbit coupling is quite large and where the bandwidth is quite small. Now, this introduces a serious problem for us, because it also happens that when the bandwidth is small, and in exactly these critical cases, you also are not sure whether or not you get localization phenomena occurring at the same time. So you'd like, in physics, to separate out one problem. I would like to be able to separate out the problems of orbital moments in itinerant systems. But where they are actually large and where the important experiments have been done, you also have the doubt that maybe there is something else happening as well. That is, there might be localization occurring. So that has always been a bit of a problem, and you can never be quite sure whether the theory that we're using for itinerant systems is in fact the correct one, when in fact there might be what you might call simultaneously what I would call a Hubbard problem at the same time. So they're difficult to sort out. The bottom part of this slide shows a...
Well, Mike, sorry to interrupt you. What about sort of non-FP system? Electrons have a really big 5P, 6P, 7P electrons on systems like that. They are very delocalized.
But do they have magnetic moments?
No, probably not.
It's the problem is the band. You need the moment formation at the same time.
Well, I mean, you would need a big magnetic field, and that would be
yes.
The job. It would have to be big.
Yes. I mean, one of the cases, the extreme case that we know about, is if you take something like uranium, the spin orbit splitting of the 6P states is absolutely enormous. We're talking about half a Rydberg, but it's not involved in the magnetism. I'll take an example here of some calculations I made some time ago using the Dirac equation. And the idea is to see how important is spin orbit coupling with energy bands. If the bands are broad, then basically you have, take for example the D states, you've got the three halves and the five half states. And if the bands are broad, these three halves and five half states will essentially overlap. So if you go into your calculations using the Dirac equation, you go and look at how many electrons do I have in the three halves and the five half states, then they should be in the ratio of 2/3 if spin orbit coupling is not important, because you have that's the number of states in the two bands. And that's exactly what happens in the 6D states, they're not shown here, in the axonites, because the bands are so broad that spin-orbit coupling is not important. But if you go to the F states, the ratio then should be 6 over 8. And if you look at something like thorium, it is about 6 over 8, because thorium has got very broad F bands. But as the bands narrow, as you go through the series, you find that actually you start to get preferential occupation of the 5 halves over the 7 halves band, which means they're separating off, that spin-orbit coupling is becoming comparable with the bandwidth. And then, of course, if you spin-polarize such a kind of system, you expect to find a significant contribution to the orbital moment. So I have a couple of overheads, which are basically about some of the properties you expect to find when you include spin-orbit coupling in the calculations. This first one is basically about cerium. We're taking one F electron, and the G factor is 6 over 7, I think. And I've written down the 7 halves and 5 halves wave functions, and these lines here is due to the fact I can't handle these, some of this technology. They should be column matrix, so it's not divided by. So here we have the 7 halves, the 7 halves and the 3 halves states. And from this, I want to form the density matrix. So I can form a spin density matrix from this by writing these wave functions in the form for L plus or minus half. I can write them like this. And then I can write down from that the density matrix, and I can calculate the various spin components and so on. There's a mistake there. That should be 2 before the mu there. So this is, for the J equal L minus half state, is the spin density matrix. Now, what I've done here is to go a little bit further than usual, in that I haven't taken a spherical average. So I've actually just written straight down the spin density matrix, and what happens is you get, in the off-diagonal elements, you get a product of two spherical harmonics, which can then be resolved into a single spherical harmonic like this. And you notice that that the diagonal elements don't depend upon angle, but here, the off-diagonal elements of the spin density matrix depend upon angle through the spherical harmonics. And if you work out then what they look like, you find they have the sort of form sine 2 theta e to the minus I phi plus sigma plus and sigma minus sine 2 theta e to the I phi. And the meaning of this is that actually if you don't take the spherical average, that in addition to a uniform spin density, you have a component which actually points radially outwards. In other words, the magnetic moments are not collinear inside of the atom. So that's one of the rather more important, or possibly important, effects of spin-orbit coupling, is that in general, the spin densities are not collinear. And here, for example, as I've said, it turns out that at the equator and the poles, this contribution is zero, but this is taken through a plane halfway up. And so in addition to the constant magnetic moment, you have this sort of thing occurring. And this, we think, might be important for what you would call reduction of the spin moments. That is, because they don't have to be collinear, as you are normally used to in normal spin density functional theory, you could actually have formation of moments where the total moment is actually not all that large, but inside of the atom, it's there, but pointing in different directions, and integrating over the total atom to zero. And so this possibility is there, and I think in all calculations we're making of this kind, we have to allow for this possibility as an extra variational degree of freedom, which means that we must keep the off-diagonal elements of the density matrix in our calculations.
We assume here that the system is in JJ coupling, right?
Yes, I've taken an extreme case.
When is it reasonable in the periodic table to make that assumption? Because the correlations, one would say, favors LS coupling, right?
This is the problem. If you do a single electron theory and you have large spin orbit coupling, you automatically land in JJ or intermediate coupling.
Right.
If, on the other hand, you believe that Coulomb correlations on the atom are extremely large or the most important part of the problem, then you always finish up with LS coupling, as in a rare earth.
Right.
And we have a competition between these two possibilities.
But just to orient myself, for example, in americium, would you say that one should treat this by LS coupling or by JJ coupling?
Well, my own belief is that in americium the electrons are localized, and therefore I would treat it like a rare earth in LS coupling.
LS coupling, but nevertheless it's J equal to zero.
You get J equal to zero from LS coupling.
I see. Okay.
Six electrons.
Okay.
Actually, this will come up, but okay. So you can, as I've done here, you can take this kind of problem. I took for this illustration here. I took a particular state, which was the J equal L minus half with maximum value of M. You can play small games to look at the properties of these types of wave functions by just diagonalizing Hamiltonian cycle tests and put in an exchange splitting. And if you do that, you go through the range of intermediate coupling. Basically, in a large exchange field, you have a spin of one for this one state and an orbital moment of -3. And then as you reduce the exchange field, you go to the JJ coupling limit. And in terms of a single electron theory, we can handle all of that. The great thing about spin orbit coupling is it is a single electron effect. So there's nothing really involved that a good computer program won't solve for you. It's not a many body problem in that sense. I've gone a little further with that and made a model where one goes across. This is actually taken for an F electron series, but it could be if there were just 10 states D's, just as good. I've gone across this series and used that Hamiltonian that I showed you before and a self-consistent exchange field and looked at the energy levels in this series. And here, at the end, the shell is filled, and therefore there can be no exchange field until you see what we've got here are 8 states and 6 states split by spin orbit coupling. And then as the exchange field, as we reduce the number of electrons, a spin can form in the lowest, filling the lowest energy state here, and so on. And as the spin forms, you get a self-consistent exchange field. And one of these states will split off, because here, if there were no spin-orbit coupling, we'd simply have spin up and spin down. This would be gadolinium in the rare earth series. And so what we've got is here, the degeneracy you expect, or almost degeneracy from a pure spin system, with 7 electrons on each side, spin up and spin down, whereas here at the other end, you've got the spin-orbit split. System. So when doing calculations like this, we have to be able to go over that full range. But again, it's not a serious problem. And what I've done here is I've calculated the properties filling up these states with the appropriate number of electrons going from 1 to 14, and calculated such properties as the orbital and spin moments, the G factor, and so on you get from this sort of self-consistent calculation. And I compare it, and this goes back now to Gabby's question. I compare this, which is basically not JJ, but intermediate coupling, but single electron theory, with the results of Russell-Sanders coupling here. Okay, and I'm only showing these because it's the kind of thing which one doesn't normally think about too much, but it's interesting to look at. Basically, the single electron theory, as you can see, gives very similar results for the total moments, the G factor, and the orbital moment and the spin moments, on the whole, going through the series. This is rather surprising in my view, but they do give more or less similar results. But in critical cases, it goes wrong. For example, here, the total moment is zero in the single electron theory, is zero for 5 electrons here. And it's not zero in Russell-Sanders coupling for 5 electrons. Okay? And Russell-Sanders coupling is basically a realization of many-body theory. You simply say that Coulomb interactions between electrons are invariant under simultaneous translation of the coordinates of all of the electrons, and therefore the appropriate quantum number is J, and you project everything onto J and use the Vignette-Eckhart theorem. So here, for 5 electrons, we get significant differences, and of course for 6 electrons, in Russell-Sanders coupling, you have J equals zero, and therefore the total moment is zero, but in the single electron theory, we get a finite value for the moment, because we don't have this dynamics. Okay. But on the other hand, it turns out that in other places here, in fact, the two approximations give surprisingly similar results.
Mike, okay. Let me clarify something. For J equals zero, J is equal to zero because S is equal to 3 and L is equal to 3, and they're absolutely correct. But the magnetic moment is L plus 2X. And J equals zero means there's no projection of the magnetic moment along any particular direction, but the magnetic moment squared is not zero.
Mu squared is not zero, no.
Right.
It isn't for any of these, because that mu squared involves all the off-diagonal elements. It's a fluctuation term.
So the expectation value of the moment is zero, if J equals zero.
Right.
But not the moment squared. So it's clarification of just what it means.
Yes, okay, that's right. Yes, fair enough. That's right. So in the susceptibility is different from the saturation moment. But it's a nice illustration of where the single electron theory is not including correlations, actually, as a matter of fact, because the whole point about projecting onto J is it's a correlation effect.
Just one example. I mean, let's take americium. As you say, we have 6 electrons.
Yeah, this is the case that you mentioned, actually,
right, so
here.
L,
right.
L would be equal to 3, right? And then the spin, presumably, it's all parallel, right? So we have 6 electrons.
Now, L is equal to 6 in americium. Must be the same as the spin.
How do you get L equal to 6?
Isn't it? Here's the Russell-Sanders coupling. Let's
have 3 and...
We'll have six. Have minus 3,
yes.
Minus 2, sorry, 3, 2, 1, 0,
minus
1, 2.
Yes. So it's like minus 3.
Yes. S is 3 and L is 3.
S is 3 and L is 3, okay.
Right.
That's right.
So the moment is definitely non-zero.
Hund's rule, right. Hund's rule gives J equals 0. But
the moment is L plus 2S,
right.
And it should be big. But the expectation value is in the J equals 0.
So the moment is equal to G times J.
The component of the moment. The vector moment is 0. So there's nothing for the magnetic field to couple to.
Right, but that's a many body thing. This is if you're really doing something like dynamic mean field theory where you're really building the correct atomic configuration. How does the band theory get that? That's the thing that I never understood.
It doesn't get it. This is the reason that I actually showed these two things here. And I'm glad that I did now. I thought first maybe you shouldn't go through this kind of stuff. But I think this is something one tends to forget when one's making energy band calculations the whole time. One adds up moments in a certain way. And this does not correspond to the highly correlated model. And it shows itself exactly here at 6 electrons. Right? Because, of course, the moments in the Russell-Sanders scheme are always G times J. It's the old atomic model of spinning around J. Yes. And so one gets 0 moment. So those are some of the considerations that we have, and this particularly highlights where one can have pitfalls in making single electron calculations. The next thing I want to talk about is the problem of screening, which is going to come up. And of course, one thinks always of GW, but for various reasons, which I'll explain in a moment, I got involved in the problem of Thomas Fermi screening, and of course, it's the simplest possible way to screen. And we know at least that in the long wave limited, it's correct, and zero frequency. So the idea in Thomas Fermi, of course, is that one has simply the Poisson equation. And if we put in a test charge somewhere here, a charge will be induced in a free electron gas. And we want to find out what the induced charge is, essentially. And...
isn't the moment for americium under pressure known?
You're still thinking about it when we were going
on.
Okay.
it's 20 years ago.
The moment, I think, is zero.
The moment under pressure.
Zero.
Now, Ollie, I think we have to be a bit careful here. They've done a lot of work on americium, and they've made high pressure experiments through the various phases. But they have no idea what the magnetic moment is, of course, because it cannot be measured under these kinds of pressures because they're done in diamond anvil conditions. So the moment of americium at ambient pressure is zero. But what it is under pressure, they have absolutely no idea, and that's a big question. And it doesn't seem to be something that one can measure at all easily because these pressures that they actually use are quite high, and under those pressure conditions, you can't measure magnetic moments. So let's just say we don't know in this case. But you were thinking about that, and probably the kind of thing you're thinking about is under pressure, if one had, for example, basically Russell-Sanders coupling at ambient pressure, under pressure, eventually these rules will break down, will become more itinerant. And of course, it would be wonderful if one could make experiments of that type under those pressures, but you can't do it.
So you expect eventually you will go to a limit where the band theory would work?
Well, it always does, eventually. Yes. Okay. So Thomas Fermi, I think everybody knows. Basically, one has to find another relationship this is the Poisson equation between the induced density and V. And of course, one makes a classical approximation, which is illegal in quantum mechanics, that one can express the kinetic and potential energies adding together as a function of R equal to the Fermi energy. And so with a small expansion of the kinetic energy in terms of the density, because the kinetic energy is related to the density in the Sommerfeld model, one can work out what the induced density is, put it into here, and in fact what one finds is one screened the potential. And the screening, of course, is the Yukawa form, simple as possible. One other remark I have about this is that screening is done in terms of the total density for which we have an expression. This total density in the Sommerfeld model, of course, is related to the density of states per unit volume at the Fermi level. And in fact, one could also formulate this a slightly different way, in which the induced density was related to the density of states at the Fermi level. And then if one was using this screening in a band theory, one could perhaps use the density of states at the Fermi level rather than the total density. In the Sommerfeld model, because of the relationship between the density of states and the total density, these two things are the same. But in the band theory, they wouldn't be. And it's one of the possibilities I'm looking into. Although, obviously, it's going to break down for insulators, because in that case, there'd be no screening, and we know that there is screening in insulators. So these two possibilities here, and I'm going to be, in the screening that I've been doing, I'm going to be using this. I'm going to be using the total density. And the reason for this is it happened, actually, sort of accidentally. I read a paper by Mike Norman, in which he was looking at analysis of uranium iron, 4-plus iron he chose, which had been done by people from experiment, from spectroscopy, and some multi-configurational Hartree-Fock calculations. And he asked himself whether he couldn't reproduce the same results, this is the experimental result, by using a Yukawa potential and adjusting kappa, the screening length, or the inverse of it, to see what he could come up with in compared with experiments. So this would be the Hartree-Fock result for the F0 integral here. It's enormous, and of course it's much bigger than an experiment. And what Norman found was that if he used a kappa of about 1.6, he was able to reproduce the experimental results. So this is for F0, this is for F2, F4, and F6. So here is his 1.6, and you see he reproduces the experimental results quite well. So that's for all of the Slater integrals which are relevant, F0, 2, 4, and 6. So when I was reading this paper, I thought, well, okay, he's adjusted this, but this is an atomic calculation. It's relatively easy to express, to actually calculate kappa from the total density and see what it gives. Does it give nonsense, or does it give something which makes some kind of sense? So I essentially went into the atomic calculations. I was using LDA calculations for atoms, and I put in screening kappa and used the Thomas-Fermi relationship, which I showed you in the previous slide, namely kappa squared. Kappa essentially goes as to the sixth power of the total density. And when I did this and calculated those integrals, the TF, or Thomas-Fermi result, is given here. I reproduced almost exactly the experiment all the way along the line.
But and it was, your state depends on position, no? Where
well,
do you take
well I'm using the actual electron density, and it depends upon position.
So how do you...
So I actually have a position-dependent kappa. Uh-huh. And the problem with a position-dependent kappa is that where do you take the density? Do you take it at the source? You've got the interaction between R.
Right.
You take it at the source? Well, it doesn't matter if you take it at the source or where the thing is received. They give the same answer. But the problem is that because the density is non-uniform, you can get different answers. So what I did was, in the end, I tested first of all the source, then the other side, R prime, and then I tried in the middle. And I found I didn't get differences in the calculations that were under the 10% limit that I'm sort of concerned about, under the 5%. So I thought, okay, I'm doing it radially. I'll take it between R and R prime. So all of these calculations that I talk about, I've taken it in the midpoint.
And how does it depend on the radius of my Muffington sphere?
Well, this is a free atom.
Oh, okay.
Okay, we'll come to the Muffington spheres, or I don't have any Muffington spheres in calculations that I do, actually. I only have lignocite spheres, but okay. But for the free atom, there's no such problem there. And if you use this Thomas Fermi screening, the results of the experiment are reproduced more or less exactly.
What are the experiments for? I mean, your calculation is for a free ion.
Yes.
Free ion.
Yes.
With this modified tissue cover, with this green long
detection. Yes.
What is the experiment for?
The experiments I never looked at because Mike Norman analyzed them, but basically there were spectroscopic experiments, okay, in which people then used Partree-Fock calculations to reproduce certain energy levels and so on. Okay, so the analysis of that was not done by me. I simply took the results that he had in his paper and asked myself what I got if I put in this screening.
What Mike was trying to do is reproduce a ton of spectroscopic data in the atom. That was sort of the days that Frosty Fisher was able to do this multi-configurational Hartree-Fock calculation. So they had tons of experimental data. And then he noticed that by fixing U and somehow some RACA parameters, F0, F2, F4, he was able to feed a lot of that stuff.
That's the point, I think. And I think the point is that the values given by Norman here for these values of the F integrals are the ones which reproduce the experiments. And so I simply said, well, first of all, I didn't expect this to work. I just thought, let's try this and see what happens. And I was impressed by the fact that without any further human intervention, I was actually getting rather good agreement. It was sufficient for me to decide to go on with this.
The sort of previous Kuhn's theory, I'm again going 30 years back now, with the renormalized atom thing, yes,
Yes.
What would that have been? Would that have been appropriate to use in this case? The renormalized atom thing, you put everything in your sphere, you say, well, in this thing, the uranium is so big, and the major effect goes back to Hering, is actually that uranium is in P electrons screen, so they get cut off, get renormalized by the sphere, and then they are the ones doing the screening.
But I don't see how that would help me to get these particular integrals. You mean I would do a renormalized atom and then calculate these Slater integrals for the renormalized atom and see if they came out correctly?
Yeah.
I don't know.
In the renormalized atom method, what you do is you fix the occupations a la Hartree-Fock or in density functional theory, and then you look at the excitation spectra.
Yes.
And that's a different game.
Yes. It's actually a more difficult thing to do. The interesting thing about this is that once you've actually got this program, it goes along by itself. So obviously you can see what my interest in this was, of course, because of the screening. One's interested in such things as calculating the F0 integral in a solid and as an alternative to the local spin density approximation. Now, having done that, I then went on and I thought, well, how is it for other atoms? And I wanted to find something where I could make a comparison with some standard, which would tell me whether using this Thomas Fermi screening was giving me nonsense or whether it was making some kind of sense. And the way that I chose, again, because I'm interested in magnetism, was to make a comparison of exchange integrals. By the way, before I go on with that, here is the screening in the atom, which is dependent upon radius, of course, because it depends upon density. And what's interesting about it, I find, is it's very, very robust. And the reason is that it actually goes as the 1/6 power of the density. So for gadolinium, uranium, and nickel, it, generally speaking, has the same form. And notice that Mike Norman chose 1.6, and that's exactly what this is coming to out here in all three atoms. So to make a comparison and see how this was working, I thought, well, why not calculate the exchange interactions using the Slater integrals? The exchange integral matrices are well known. This goes back to the work of Ole Gunnarsson years ago when he pointed out that you could take the local spin density approximation and you can calculate the exchange interactions, and this has been done for atoms throughout the periodic table. You can do a similar thing with the Slater, with the Hartree-Fock type of theory. You can express it in the same kind of form, but now to calculate the same exchange interaction or the equivalent, which gives a spin polarization energy, you have to calculate some Wigner coefficients and some Slater integrals and take linear combinations. So I went ahead and did this. At the same time, not using, I actually did it for unscreened integrals, but also with this screening. And the screening, you can calculate. Here's the kappa here. And you have an expression. Then you can re-express this exponential in this form. So you need to calculate some Bessel functions and and Hankel functions of imaginary argument and so on, and do the integrals. These are the integrals for the exchange interactions. And the results of doing this are shown down below. First of all, these are the unscreened exchange integrals using the Hartree-Fock approximation. And at the bottom, down here, the very small integrals are the results of the local spin density approximation, which have been known for years, which I've recalculated there. Well, of course...
Sorry, how do you put these integrals in the local spin density approximation?
Which one do you want to know? You want to know...
What does it mean? I mean, if I understand correctly, what Norman said first is e to the minus kappa r with kappa fixed. And then he took the wave functions for Hartree-Fock and he did the integral, right?
Yes.
Now, what you're saying is let's be a little bit more sophisticated. Let's put kappa as a function of r, and then let's do the Coulomb integral, mm-hmm. right, with the r-dependent.
Mm-hmm.
So then there is, and I assume that's your one of the entries in that table, right?
Yes.
And then there's also spin density functional, but in density functional theory, there are not these Coulomb integrals, right?
Yes.
So what is that curve, LSTA there?
The LSTA. The LSTA is done from a different calculation. It's done from a LSTA calculation. That is, I've done LDA and calculated this exchange interaction according to the LDA prescription for comparison.
On atom or for solid or what?
For an atom. Okay.
So you put a density-dependent exchange potential in there in the interval or what?
Maybe I didn't explain this enough. What I've actually done for the what I call the LDA exchange integrals is to actually take an LDA calculation and do this integral here, which is a prescription which was actually given in papers by Gunnarsson in the 70s. And this J here comes into the expression for the spin polarization energy in LSDA,
the
well-known
what,
expression.
What the A is?
What is the A here?
Yes.
That is a well-known function of density which depends upon which particular approximation you use. I use Barth-Eden. But if you were to use Vosko, that would vary slightly. But I don't believe that the exchange integrals vary by more than a few percent.
This is secondary, right?
The magnetic part of the exchange.
Yes,
Second variation of exchange potential energy with respect to magnetic to spin polarization, right?
So I try to use these, because they're published, I mean, and well-known, I try to use these as a sort of standard. And then to say if I'm using these screened integrals from Hartree-Fock theory, how do they compare with the LSDA results? That's all. Okay? So these are the LDA results, LSDA results, I should say. these are the unscreened. And now, if I look at the Hartree-Fock screened using Thomas Fermi, it looks like this. It's larger. It's larger than the, essentially, the Gunnarsson integrals. And what I've also done is to look at the contributions to the screened interaction. And one of them, or half of it, comes from the F0 integral, was the first thing that I actually noticed. So F0, or the Hubbard U, if you like, makes a rather large contribution to these Hartree-Fock screened interactions, even though it's been screened down from a very large value to a small value. The other thing which I noticed was that if I look at something like a rare earth, and I look at the exchange interaction between an F state and, for example, a D state, where U doesn't come in, I get exactly the same result from a screened, using the Thomas Fermi screening and the Hartree-Fock, I get the same result as you do from LSDA. So my conclusion from this was that the exchange integrals, or the spin polarization energy, another way of putting it, is not exactly the same when I use Thomas Fermi screening as it is when you use LSDA, but it's not so tremendously different. In other words, this very large value you get for the unscreened interactions is reduced significantly. And one of the things that bothered me a little bit about this was that when I look right across, because I made these for the whole periodic table, at the differences, I always seem to get about 1.5 times what the LSDA was giving, the famous factor of 2/3, which has occurred in previous cases. There it is with the Cohn-Shaman Slater. So the 2/3 seems to be occurring here again for reasons I can't fully understand. So now, being in the position to at least have some reasonable values for the screened Slater integrals, I want to just take a look at how far one has to go in actually trying to polarize in an actual solid-state calculation. And the simplest thing to do would be to forget everything else and to use the so-called Hubbard-U approximation, which is what people have been doing, and that's called LDA plus U. So let me just take a look for a couple of minutes at LDA plus U as it might apply to the kind of problem I'm working with here to get orbital moments. And basically, the U problem is the following. One has the interaction energy between electrons, and this is summed over the electrons. This is the direct, and this is the exchange term. The F0 integral comes from the spherical part of 1 over r minus r prime. So since it's a spherical part, it can be taken out and integrated into the F0 integral, and you're left with these two guys here. And they, if you work them out, of course, this is just equal to 1 for all I and j, and this is equal to delta ij. So basically what you get is ni nj minus ni squared times delta ij. And this is the expression for the interaction energy which causes all the trouble. If we were to differentiate that with respect to an occupation number, and the way I've done this is I've just said, well, let's just take some occupation numbers here, which is what everybody does, okay? Differentiate with respect to occupation number, then I will get energies or eigenvalues which basically look like this. If a state is occupied, then we have NL, this is the total number of electrons minus 1. In other words, it doesn't see itself. But if it's not occupied, it sees all the other electrons. So this Ni squared here is a self-interaction correction. Okay? It is the self-interaction correction, and it is nothing other than the self-interaction correction. Okay? For the F0 integral. Now I want to look at the first LDA plus U very briefly. In the first LDA plus U, as far as I can see, what it essentially was saying was that LDA corresponds to the spherical approximation, that is, all of the orbitals, the ni's are all equal. I think that's what was meant. And now the problem is, the following problem is arising, which is there for me if I'm calculating orbital moments, which is there for you if you're doing something else, such as the localization problem. Because the atoms and the atom cores and most of the calculation is made using LDA or a correction to it, perhaps a gradient correction or something like this, if you're going to start adding things like this for the valence states, then you've got to be careful you don't count something twice. So you're faced with the problem that if you're going to do this, then you must take away what is already there in LDA. Okay, and that is the seems to me the whole idea of LDA plus U. So the first statement that was made was that LDA corresponds to equal occupation. That is a spherical approximation. I don't believe that that's right, but this is what was done. And so one subtracted off from this expression, one subtracted off this spherical part. Okay, and one arrived at an expression for the interaction energy and for the eigenvalues when you want to differentiate with respect to Ni. That was the first LDA plus U. The second one, and there is a third, of course, for the spin-polarized case, but the second one struck me as being more interesting because in the second one, one said that LDA plus LDA corresponds to, if NL is the number of electrons in a shell, then LDA corresponds to, essentially, the interactions treated as the sum over pairs. Now, if I have interactions between objects, and I write the total energy as a sum over pairs, that means that the object must have the value 1 or 0. Okay? So this is just the sum over pairs of electrons, and this is what was claimed corresponded to LDA plus U. The sum over pairs means that it's saying that in LDA, that the electron number in an orbital is either equal to 1 or 0, which in my view is also false. So this was subtracted off, and when you subtract it off, you get an expression which looks like this, and when you differentiate it, you get eigenvalues which look like the following. If the orbital is empty, it goes up, and if it's filled, it goes down. So it has a very clear effect, which is beloved of people working, for example, with a Hubbard-U, which is that it tends to localize electrons, because those states which are filled, the energy goes down, and those states which are empty, the energy goes up. So if you do a self-consistent calculation, you tend to fill a state. That's the effect. But look at it again more carefully and see what's happened here. What we've done is we've subtracted off the sum over pairs from this expression for the interaction energy. And this means, if you look carefully, you see that the direct Coulomb term here cancels that exactly. And so what's left behind is basically the self-interaction term from here minus the proposed self-interaction term from the case where n is equal to 1 or 0, that is the LDA. So all that's actually left in this LDA plus U are actually the difference of two types of self-interaction. And there's nothing else other than self-interaction involved. Okay? And this, for me, produces tremendous problems in the case of, it gets worse, of orbital moments. It's been associated with spin polarization. Well, let me just take a look at that. Of course, in the case of the S state, it clearly is, because in the case of an S state, if you do a paramagnetic calculation, then you're basically putting half an electron with spin up and half an electron with spin down. So the two halves of an electron interact, and you get an interaction energy, which is nonsense for hydrogen. So what do? You spin polarize it. When you spin polarize it, then there is just one electron state filled up, and because of the self-interaction, the energy is zero. So this is the spin polarization energy for hydrogen, and it looks very much as if this F0, or the LDA plus U, has got something to do with magnetism. Okay? However, if I take D states, here are five of them, and I put two electrons with spin up into these D states, okay, then this, using the LDA plus U, this electron does not interact with itself, neither does this one, so the energy of interaction is between the two electrons. I can put one in with spin up, and I can put one in with spin down. They don't interact with themselves, but the interaction energy is exactly the same, whether they spin up or spin down. So in the degenerate case, there is absolutely no difference, and in fact, the F0 does not, in this sense, spin polarize the system at all. And it gets worse. If you go to the relativistic case, which we're dealing with, then you have states, for example, take the J equal 5 half states. So we take D states here, minus 3 halves, minus a half, and so on. It turns out that this interaction energy using F0 is exactly the same form if you have relativistic states as well. You don't have to have just spin up and spin down. And so if I put an electron into the minus 3 halves and the 3 half states, as regards the F0 integral, it has exactly the same energy as if I put it into minus half, minus 3 halves, and minus a half. In other words, the entire energy using F0 is self-interaction energy and nothing else.
But the way that LDA plus U solve this problem is by orbital polarization, by just polarizing in the orbitals. Now the occupation of the different orbitals, the different m's, mm-hmm. the d-shell will be different.
Yes, and if you put spin-orbit coupling in, it'll make the minus 3 halves more occupied, and that will then go down because it's occupied, and so you'll get polarization.
Right.
The problem is the following. That if
I think that's the idea of LDA plus U, right?
Let me start off a calculation. This has happened to me with plutonium. So let me start off a calculation where I'll just take one electron to make it easy. I start my calculation off with more occupation in the minus 3 halves than any other state, and I have a large U.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? I'm going to polarize till this state is filled.
Yeah.
Let me start the calculation off now with this state. The same thing will happen. This will polarize.
Yeah.
And the energies will be exactly the same.
No, it won't.
Yes, it will.
It's different. It actually does, surprisingly enough, like these calculations for F materials, you can actually stabilize a wrong configuration. But more often than not, the system at some point, while it's shaking during self-consistency, always falls into the right configuration. And that's this interplay between spin-orbit interaction and just
right.
density change and everything. But it doesn't work that way, as you describe.
The two different things we're talking about here. If you're making an actual energy band calculation with all the stuff in, with the energy bands and with the spin orbit coupling and these various things, the spin orbit coupling will favor the occupation of various states. If you have a spin this way, it will favor, for example, the minus 3 half states and so on. But I'm isolating.
Even if you start with the wrong configuration, so you fill up this your 3 half states, and you take large U and you start with self consistency, sometimes the system stays in this state, but very often. Nevertheless, turns around and eventually converges to the right state.
But you are talking about a full energy band calculation.
Yeah.
I'm talking here about a model where I remove the energy bands and just look at the effect of U itself, F0, without any of these other things.
Yeah,
and if I only have U...
Have you turned off the spin-orbit coupling?
Let me turn off everything and look at the effect of U isolated just by itself. And my point is, if I just have U and I start a calculation in the minus 3 halves...
Yeah.
I will finish it in the minus 3 halves. If I start in any of these states, I will finish up in those states.
As it should be.
Yeah.
Because the atom is spherically symmetric, and
you should not
refer one over the other.
Yeah.
Yes, but at the same time, there is no, in the U itself, there is nothing other in what I would call, other than what I would call self-interaction.
But why do you think there should be something?
There shouldn't be, because it's spherically symmetric,
yeah.
Right?
Well, when you look at the, when you go further and look at the exchange integrals, you find there's a great deal more than just self-interaction when we get into the real exchange problem. So we disagree about this, but let me go one step further now and say what I propose as a for orbital polarization, something which is completely different to using this, which I find has its problems. And this is the following. I say that, first of all, the subtraction being made to get what you call LDA, okay, is not correct. That those two expressions which you use to subtract off.
I disagree with that also. I think it is okay. Correct. It's just the way how you interpret it.
Well, they can't both be correct because they're different. There are two versions so far, and they actually differ. So they can't both be correct.
They can. I mean, that's the difference. So maybe we should have discussion about.
Yes.
That.
Okay. Okay.
But they can. Yes.
Yeah. So although they're different, they're both correct.
In different limits.
In different limits.
Okay.
For each system, there is one way to do it right.
So the point of view which I wish to adopt is that I don't know, I can't fathom exactly what is in the LDA and what to subtract off. It's something which in the atom, the exchange correction is varying with density throughout the atom and all these kinds of things. And I can't.
That, like you subtract something from LDA. That's not true. You add Hubbard term and then you subtract LDA of this Hubbard correction.
Yes.
And that's a kind of uniquely defined thing. You don't try to identify an LDA
okay.
part term.
But then you don't know how much of this corresponds to something you've already got in the LDA calculation. That is the problem for me.
No, but at the point, you say that LDA calculation is a good way to take into account charge distribution mean field Coulomb. Now you add a correction, and then you subtract from this correction this local density approximation to this correction, to Hubbard model.
Yes.
Let's go.
Fair enough.
This is philosophical, so let's go on.
But that's, it's the same formula you can define and derive and interpret in different ways. In one way, you find that it's illogical. In the other way, you find it's perfectly logical.
Okay. Let me move on. Because I say that I don't know what's an LDA, I propose doing things slightly differently, which is to say the following, which is that my charge density, or my density, or density matrix, can be divided into two parts. If I use the time reversal operator on this, one of the parts will change sign and one will not. So I have a part which is invariant on the time reversal and a part which is not. And what I'm going to say is I wish to use LDA for everything which is invariant under time reversal. And spin polarization, orbital polarization are to do for me with the removal of time reversal. So I separate out my density matrix in this way, and I create what I would call a part which changes sign under time reversal and a part which remains invariant on the time reversal. I then go back and look at the interaction energy here, and I find that as regards the Coulomb part, that only involves the part which is invariant on the time reversal, and so I can write something which is invariant on the time reversal, which I call LDA. I leave that alone and don't touch what's been going on through all the years. And there's a second part where essentially this changes sign on the time reversal, and this is the density matrix which I wish to use in order to calculate the spin polarization and orbital polarization. Okay, so I separate distinctly into a magnetic part and a non-magnetic part, and the non-magnetic part is what has been traditionally used for LDA calculations, and I simply leave it alone. Okay. So now I wish to calculate exchange interactions using a density matrix where I subtracted off the.
So you're putting R minus R prime there in the formula? I mean, there's a Coulomb interaction missing.
1 over R minus R prime.
Oh, yes, that's missing. Yeah, that's missing.
But is that screened, unscreened, or what?
Screened.
By your kappa?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. But the difference, I went through this LDA plus U thing to show the problems that I have with it,
right.
And I prefer this prescription.
So
because this separates out.
The magnetic part.
Yes, exactly. And so the rest of the calculation is done without interference.
So you simply throw away the U and keep the J in some sense.
U is still there.
Where?
U is still in here.
No.
Oh, yes.
This is the magnetic part. There's no F0A.
The F0,
there
is an F0 in there, yes.
How is that?
What I'm using is that part of the density matrix which changes sign under time reversal.
Yeah, and the charge is invariant under time reversal.
Yes.
You separate charge channel and spin channel.
Yes.
And that is U and J.
No, they don't separate out that way.
I don't get it either.
Yeah, I know that people think that way, but that's actually not true. The F0 actually is still used in this calculation here.
So you don't like the way how LSD8 reads spin channel, basically, right? Magnetic channel?
Yes.
You think that is correct?
Yes.
So if I would take a homogeneous electron gas and spin polarize that, you would still be unhappy with the way how LSD8 describes...
No, my problem arises from the fact that if I use LSD8, the spin part, which you like to call the spin channel, that when I calculate orbital magnetic moments, they come out to be too small. And so what I want to do is to use a more orbital type of theory.
But in some materials they come too small, in some materials they come right. I don't see...
Are you telling me that in a LSDA calculation, that you have made calculations in which you have calculated an orbital moment which has been too large compared with experiment?
Orbital moments, spin moments. But then
I'm talking about orbital.
But you're taking the whole thing away. You don't leave spin-dependent interaction in LDA at all, right? You say that whenever you have violations, breaking of time reversal variance, you have to do something else. You have to correct that. So that applies to spin moment as well, not only to orbital moment, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course, because I have to treat them on an equal footing. Yes.
Okay, let's go on.
Different question. So right here, these equations you're doing are free fall.
Screened.
Right.
Yes.
Now, in Hartree-Fock theory, when you write down the equations, there's no self-interaction because the determinant wave function doesn't allow that, and there's no self-exchange. Now, when people write computer programs, it's often easy to include the self-interaction term, so you have a density-density Hartree term, and subtract out the self-exchange,
yes,
which is the same term, and that's fine. Are you using that point of view here and getting an F0 term in the exchange because of that?
Yes.
I was wondering.
Yes. Yes, because my problem has been that in my LDA, I'm calculating for all electrons. I have the total Coulomb, and so I need to keep the self-interaction in the exchange. Okay? But I'm only going to be treating... this is only ever going to get used when I come to spin polarize. That means that LDA calculations remain exactly the same. So it's always getting impatient and the time is going on.
Can you explain that point? Because for me it's very confusing to find an F0 in there. Can you explain what you just said? Why there is F0 in something where there's no charge?
Well, it's because the self-interaction, self-exchange term, which is fictitious, but it's there because you put in a self-interaction, which wasn't there in Hartree-Fock theory either. It's because that exchange integral, and only that one, is F0.
Yep.
But you subtract it out, or you don't?
If you add the self-interaction in the, what you call a Hartree term, which is the direct Coulomb interaction, then you have to subtract out this self-exchange just to
cancel that out. Yeah.
The second term includes exchange and self-interaction correction.
Yes.
So it
remains. So let me.
You are now these two originally canceling terms. You are now treating differently. Yes, you keep the one in the LDA and the other one you do your whatever.
I think what you say is right, but I don't understand it. So I'm believing you.
If I.
Yes, so the LDA is left the same. So now we simply use this to do the polarization, and I'll just show some of the results that one gets. This top one is always the present calculation. Okay. Then the bottom three are experiments of various kinds for iron, cobalt, and nickel. There are various sources. I think one is the Olcatel book and Daldrop's thesis, which was very thorough, and Stern's is a handbook article. And SO means these are the calculated orbital moments when you just put in smooth orbit coupling, and this is one of the older orbital polarization schemes, and this is the calculations that I've been making using these screened interactions, which of course is a very different from LSDA theory. So basically, for the total moments, I don't see any serious differences. I'm a little bit smaller on the iron, but basically, one gets essentially the correct result in all three cases, or it agrees at least with other theories and reasonably with experiment. For the spin moment, the present calculation is again reasonably good agreement with the other ones. I don't think there's any significant difference, except to within a few percent. When it comes to the calculation of the orbital moment for iron, spin orbit, this was one of the big anomalies. The orbital moment of iron was calculated to be far too small. Orbital polarization improved it. I now get agreement with the experiment. For cobalt, the situation is somewhat similar, although the previous calculations were in somewhat better agreement with the experiment, but that's not too bad. And finally, for nickel, we all seem to calculate an orbital moment which is rather larger than measured in experiments. Now, these experiments for iron, cobalt, and nickel are not made using neutrons. Okay?
Where's the experiment?
Well, I've taken three. This is from Stern's handbook article. This is from Geldrup's thesis, and this is from Cattell. So these bottom three are different versions of the experimental results. They sometimes differ. Okay?
For nickel, they differ very much.
For nickel?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, but they're only differing very much because I put in an old value from Cattell, and these are made, the trouble with nickel and these things is that the way they've made the measurements are made years ago using these gyromagnetic experiments, right? So I don't know how good they are.
Get that from the ferromagnetic resonance.
Yes, and this is probably the value given by Stearns here, yeah? So these are probably, the Geldrup Stearns, those are probably the most reliable. But I also put in these L values as well. I've got all three. And it's just in the case of nickel that you get this very big divergence.
It's a little bit of a question whether you can really define or expect the unique. When this spherical symmetry, which you need to define an orbital moment, is so badly broken, as in... And these, just whether the value of the orbital moment is uniquely defined in some way.
Yeah, it's really not obvious to me that the various experiments that are sensitive to orbital moment, in fact, measure the same quantity. Whether
yes.
You take ferromagnetic resonance or gyromechanic magnetic effects or X-ray dichroism, another source. These are all sensitive to orbital magnetism, but it's not obvious to me that they really would give the same numbers if they would be perfectly accurate.
It's not obvious to me either. I think I think in this particular, I had to put these down, iron, cobalt, and nickel, because in these particular cases, they're the classic cases where people have made the calculations and these things are there. But I think there probably should be some doubt about the...
Peter's making one point, that the total magnetic moment should be measurable and the spin plus the orbital should add up.
You're saying it's not defined.
No, I'm saying...
The separation is not exactly defined, but the total magnetic moment just...
The total moment should be...
Yeah, you can measure that and you can compare that with your calculation. You can see the total magnetic moment, period.
Yes.
And compare that with experiments.
Well, yes, that's fair enough, but it doesn't really answer my problem, which is I want to know also how well we're doing for the orbital magnetic moments. Okay? Yes. So those are the cases, the classical cases.
But
let's.
Since the orbital moment is not really a well-defined quantity, it is presumably better to do a theory and a calculation for a quantity which is well-defined, such as the G factor of ferromagnetic resonance or the thing that is measured in a particular experiment.
That is exactly what has been done, by the way, in the case when I gave those results here, the Cattell results, for example. These are actually just taken from the G factors.
Yeah.
Okay, that's not...
So what it means, the quantity that has to be measured is the G factor, one has to mimic the Zeeman effect.
Yes.
And calculate the...
Yeah. But that's a fraction of orbital character at the Fermi level only.
Yes.
Right, an orbital moment.
So that's why
this is the envelope of G factor, essentially total polarizations, spin and orbital together at the Fermi level. Why not to take instead the full separation magnetization and compare that?
The point is, if one aims at making a connection with an experiment, it would be better to get it directly observable.
So let's not get hung up on this. Let's just go to this, which is a different. This I prefer much more. Okay, that was duty to put the last ones in, but this is I think the proper way to measure orbital magnetic moments is to use neutron diffraction, and I've drawn this to make a couple of comments about what to look out for. This is an expression for the form factor. The orbital moment, because of the expansion of the plane wave, the orbital moment picks up two things. It picks up a linear combination of J0, that's an average of J0 Bessel function over the wave functions, I should say over the spin density actually, and J2. So it's a combination of this and this for the orbital part. For the spin part, we just have J0. Okay. Now, it is true that with neutrons, again, you don't actually measure individually the orbital and spin moments. You're basically scattered by the field from both of them. But because of these different shapes, we can do some analysis and we should be able to eke out what they basically are. So this is the form factor, a typical form factor then shown for the orbital part, which has this, and the spin part, which has this. And if the orbital and spin moments are parallel, as in iron, cobalt, and nickel, your problem then is you're adding these two together. And so really, whether here I've taken the spin moment of 1, orbital of 1, or 0.1, there isn't much difference. It's extremely hard to get out the orbital moment because you've got to be able to be accurate in this region here, sine theta over lambda. And that's difficult. And that's why one of the reasons we don't know dead accurately the orbital moments of iron, cobalt, and nickel. But if you take another material, which is at the beginning of a series, where spin-orbit coupling makes the spin-orbital moments anti-parallel, then you can get a cancellation occurring, because the orbital takes that and that, and the spin just that. We can get this J0 cancelling, and so here are the different examples. Typically, spin moment of -1. If we have an orbital moment of 1.2, then you can get this sort of feature, and you can analyze the form factor and get the orbital moment out. Here is if it's 1.5, and here it's if the orbital moment is less than the spin moment, okay? And then the form factor falls off more rapidly than it would otherwise do. So this is the sort of thing that one can look for if you look at the beginning of the series. And that's why I've taken as examples two fairly famous experiments. One is on cerium iron 2. This, first of all, shows the various calculated parts of the magnetic moments. It's a Laveis-based compound. I should ignore the iron, which is not at the moment particularly interesting, but it's the reason why in my calculation actually I get too big a moment. It's because the moment on the iron is too large. The situation on cerium is the following. There's been XMCD, and there've been neutrons, and there's been earlier theory, and they give, for example, for the cerium magnetic moment, they give these various results, and the present calculations are sitting here. Okay, so we agree with the neutrons on the total moment. The orbital moment, the neutrons, the people have claimed that it's basically zero. XMCD says it's very large. This is an older theory, and this is the present. And then if you look at the spin moment on cerium, we see here that it's present calculation. This is the 4F moment. The neutrons are giving zero. I'll explain this in a moment with the neutron form factor, whereas we get a 4F moment. I get a 4F moment, and so did previous theories. And I also get a contribution from the 5D spin moment. So basically, I have a spin moment from the 4F, which is a little larger than from the Ds, and I have an orbital moment, which is in the opposite direction. So the neutron scattering, the neutron people from their experiments arrived at the conclusion, and these are experts, that there was no 4F moment. And yet, when I plotted my calculated form factor with my 4F moment, when I plotted it, and these are their experimental results, I essentially get very good agreement with the experiment.
Sorry, which one is the calculation, the line?
The line is the calculation, and these points I've taken from the experimental results. Okay? And I've got this with a 4F moment and with a 4F orbital moment. And so I had to go back, actually, and look in detail at what the neutron people had done and why it is that they said there could be no 4F moment. And that led to some interesting things, actually, in looking at densities. What I like about neutrons is that they're doing the Fourier transform of the densities. So they really are very closely related to density functional theory because they do actually see densities. I plotted, wondering why they couldn't get this when they analyzed their own experiment. Of course, one realizes that they're doing, any calculations they do is they use free atoms. They use a free atom to get to calculate a form factor and so on. So I went and had a look, and I found, for example, that in the solid I have a bonding density, and the free atom you don't see it because I went and did a free atom. But then I found that this sort of cancelled out because the spin density is fairly constant, and that's to do with the fact, oh, you get the majority spin is greater here and less here, and there are various things going on, which were fairly inconclusive until I realized that their problem was they couldn't get this point here because their F form factor was somewhere up here. And so they said, well, there can't be Fs there. But what they'd forgotten was that when you do the Fs, you have a D contribution, you have an F contribution, and you have an orbital contribution, which is antiparallel. And then you get the situation, which I showed you back here. No, it's not backspace. I showed you here, that if you've got an orbital contribution which is smaller than the spin and anti-parallel, the form factor is drawn down so as it falls off more rapidly. And that's exactly what's happening in Cerium Ion 2. And that's why the theory agrees actually with experiment and at the same time agrees better with the XMCD and other experiments than the neutrons. So I think that this problem is solved. I think that we get the right answer for that. Here's another example. Uranium sulfide. This is the measured form factor, again, the circles. This is the calculation, okay, using the screened Hartree-Fock theory. I did the calculations for the 1-1-1 direction and the 1-0-0. There's an enormous difference in the spin and orbital moments for the 1-1-1 and 1-0-0 directions. The 1-1-1 is easy. That's where the orbital moment and the spin moment are largest, and that's what you would expect because there's an intrinsic relationship between the anisotropy and the size of the orbital moment. And consequently, again here, the agreement with the experiment is essentially perfect. The calculated moment is about 1.5. And that's correct from magnetization and from neutron experiments. So this was a difficult case in the past because the orbital and spin moments for uranium sulfide calculated using previous theories were actually not right. They were either using orbital polarization far too large, both of them, or using spin orbit coupling alone, the orbital moment was far too small. The final case, which has been another famous and difficult one, which goes back to experiments by Mikhail Wolf, as uranium ion 2, and this case is very interesting because this is where you get actually cancellation of orbital and spin moments. That is, the total is about zero on the uranium. So you get this hump in the form factor which allows you to distinguish and see the orbital part. Okay? If I go back, here, if basically what happens is if the orbital and spin moments cancel, that is the total moment is zero, then you get a great big hump in the form factor, and that's what's happening here. There. So these are the calculated total moments again. Okay, and there's the most reliable, the most recent experiment, and again, agreement with the experiment is essentially perfect. When I calculate the total moment on the uranium, I actually get a different sign. I get a very small moment and a different sign to what the experimentalists deduce from their form factor. We'll come back to that. But again, I get a much smaller spin moment and a much smaller orbital moment than previous theories. And when I calculate the form factor, the calculated form factor looks like this. Now, the experimentalists got a different sign because they, again, used free atom calculations and drew a best fit through here, and they came to somewhere here. That is, they had a different sign. But essentially, the orbital and spin moments are cancelling. But once again, the theory which I've been using here gives essentially perfect agreement with experiment for this particular case. So I hope that actually looking at the form factors, that it answers some of the problems which you raised about iron, cobalt, and nickel, where one has small orbital moments with spin an orbit parallel, one isn't quite sure how good the experiments are. But on the other hand, with carefully selected experiments, when the orbital and spin moments are anti-parallel, you can indeed see the effect of the orbital magnetic moment, and you do know how large it is. And in my view, from the point of view of density functional theory, the best possible way of comparing with the experiment is to compare with the neutron form factor. Because first of all, it measures the ground state. And secondly, if you choose the right cases, you actually have a chance of actually seeing the densities, which is what you're actually calculating. So I think there have been a lot of questions. I've gone rather over time. Sorry.
No further questions, I guess. Thank you very much.